Hello everyone, this is Gary Gorman and I'm delighted this morning to be talking to Moira Race about negotiation from a buyer's perspective. Now Moira is a business consultant who uses her fantastic global buying background, almost 30 years, to help businesses understand the mindset of the buyer and to help them improve their negotiations, adapt their presentations and increase their sales and client retention. Good morning, Moira.
Good morning, Gary.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's a really interesting opportunity to do both sides of the table and an investigation into negotiations.
Yeah. I mean, we thought it might be helpful for listeners in terms of, I mean, my experience, as you know, is seeing it from the seller side. I've bought cars and I've bought electrical equipment, so haggled and bargained as a buyer, but I've predominantly seen it from a sales perspective. So to get your insights and your input from a buyer's perspective and your vast experience from a buying point of view would be really helpful. So tell me how you've ended up doing what you do now.
Well, right from uni days, I've kind of always been interested in consumers, you know, what they desire, how they purchase, and the whole process they go through. And I started my career with Sainsbury's. And the best thing of being part of a huge team of, I mean, I think they have over 300 buyers probably still today. You learnt the skills from the bottom up. So it was a very clear career path into buying as such. The thing is, after 4 or 5 years, you start to want to have a little bit more freedom and less control. And I left the security of the big corporation and jumped at the chance to go into travel retail, which seemed the more glamorous option. And you know me, I like my glamour. And I can safely say that over 30 years in this industry, it's never stood still. I've traveled extensively and I've learned a lot over that time. I've been fortunate enough to buy many different categories: wine, smoked salmon, FMCG goods through Sainsbury's, into the world's most luxurious products such as Chanel and Hermes. I feel very privileged to be dealing with some of these brands. The one important thing for me is I have a passion for product. And I feel that's essential to any successful buyer, is that passion for the product. If you don't love it, you'll not be a good buyer at it. And I decided around 2 years ago to set up my own consulting business. Mm-hmm. With the aim not only to coach buyers, because there are actually very few buyer training courses where experience is the driving force. And there are a lot of sales ones. So I looked at that opportunity and felt that over the last 30 years, that experience has got to amount to something, and it'd be quite nice to share it with people coming through. But I also want to challenge brands and companies, because exactly as you just said, when people go into negotiation as a salesman, they're taught to sell. But very few are taught to actually sit back and think, actually, what does the buyer want and need? And I'm seeing that coming through a lot more as well on LinkedIn, and that whole aspect of needs and satisfying the buyer's needs. But I think a lot of people don't really know how to do that. So that's really the angle I'm taking at the moment.
Fantastic.
That's it in a nutshell.
Fantastic. So tell me about when you were buying smoked salmon. How did you go about buying smoked salmon?
That was my really early days at Sainsbury's when I was a very junior buyer. But it was smoked salmon at Christmas. And at those days, the chairman, Lord Sainsbury, was very interested in the smoked salmon over Christmas. And to get your quantities wrong and you're out of stocks on that was a fate worse than death. But perishables, this is the thing with buying. Perishables is different than buying luxury products. Is different than, you know, each category has its own certain niches that you need to consider. As a buyer, and they have to be treated slightly differently.
Mm. So how much of your time when you were buying, for the travel industry, how much time was spent in the UK and how much time was spent abroad?
It varied depending on experience and my position within the companies. But towards the end, it was probably 40% abroad.
Right. Okay. And negotiating abroad versus negotiating in the UK, from your experience, in what way is that the same and in what way does that differ?
Well, it's a good question, but there are many different facets to international negotiations, because you've got cultural and environmental differences, you've got different customs, tariffs and excise considerations. And then when you're shipping goods internationally, you have to take into account the costs and margins. So I'd probably say the actual source of supply is probably the biggest challenge. A lot of suppliers are not set up for the global deal. They all think that this is a wonderful dream to be able to sell their product internationally, but they don't often pause to think how they're actually going to achieve that. No buyers.
Why is that, Moira? Why is that?
Because of the way a lot of companies are structured. So a lot of companies have different offices in different countries. And I think one of the biggest things is they're not streamlining their communication channels for the customer structure. So what I mean by that is if you have a structure of a buying team, the sales team has to reflect that, because no buyer is going to want to deal with 60 different countries and 60 different points of contact. They want to have a global deal that they can then tweak with a 10-15% variance for the local market. So it's really important to have the authority to commit that you can deliver the deal. And that often falls flat. So you can make a deal with someone in the UK and then you try to take that to Germany. Mm-hmm. And in Germany, you'll find the local team there are going like, no, we don't do it like that. We have a different pricing structure. We have a different cost structure. We don't provide the same services. So an international deal is much more complex. And the best way to do it is to actually have an overall global framework that you can work within.
Okay. And typically, how long would these deals take to bring all the parties to an alignment?
Year, 18 months. So a long process.
Right, okay.
I mean, it does depend. If you're lucky enough to have a deal with a global business who has that infrastructure, then obviously it's a standard negotiation. But yeah. To take, and I have taken brands, UK brands, brands in the UK, and they are now the global travel retail arm. But that takes a lot of work in the background, a lot of work. You've got distribution contracts to think of as well.
Yeah, so a lot of teamwork involved, I guess, a lot of patience, a lot of resilience, those sort of qualities.
And a lot of understanding, because people are very territorial, and you really find that in international negotiation, that people don't want to give up something that they feel is important to their territory, yet may have a bigger impact on the global negotiation.
Such as what? What sort of things would they try to hold on to?
For instance, if you were doing a deal where you ship the goods from the factory direct, they might have been shipping that through a local wholesaler and have a very good deal on a local level. So if you try to cut out the local, then that country will be particularly upset, because they like to deal with the people they know. People like face-to-face negotiation and comfort zone of who they're dealing with.
Yeah.
But in an international global negotiation, you have to remove that for the bigger picture and say, actually, for the health of this deal, it has to be centrally controlled.
I see.
Okay. That's a big difference.
Yeah. Okay. Let's broaden it out a bit. Looking at negotiation from a buyer's perspective, what would you say is the trickiest thing about it that you found the most trickiest thing to manage?
I think the biggest difference is for the buyer, it's about the risk involved. A good salesman's convincing and knowledgeable, usually, about their products and services.
But, not always.
Yes, they say usually. And I said a good salesman. But the buyer is taking the risk on whether or not to stock the product. And if they do take it, will it sell? What happens if it doesn't sell? And have they actually got a good deal? There's so many different aspects that the buyer has to think about that the salesman quite often doesn't consider. And very much it's not just about price and margin. There are a lot of other criteria. Take marketing, for example. You have promotion, exclusivity, social media presence. You've got lots of things that have to be considered. Mm-hmm. One of the tips that I recommend on my successful buyer course is that the negotiation has to be as prepared as possible. And my recommendation is a checklist. In the same way a salesman will have a checklist, but a buyer's checklist is often a lot wider because they need to consider a lot of different departments. So, and they should know their numbers. That's the other key thing. A buyer that doesn't know their numbers, doesn't know their top sellers, doesn't know their space, doesn't know which brands perform, that's a huge thing that they must plan and pre-prepare before their meeting, the size and scope of their business, to limit the risk.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on preparation. It's crucial. I would say in my courses that 90% of the success is down to the preparation.
For sure. Absolutely. Preparation and knowledge. I would say knowledge as well. More probably from the buyer's point of view, because a salesman is maybe selling one product within a range. The buyer has to ensure that the bigger picture is fulfilling their criteria.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because I use the phrase get inside the buyer's head when I'm, you know, work with sales teams. But it's interesting that you've broadened that out a little bit in terms of thinking about potential risk and potential, what happens if things don't sell? What happens if things go wrong?
What's your exit strategy? What am I going to do? You know, how, and that actually is a big part of the negotiation, because if the supplier can think how to help the buyer limit that risk, whether it's a risk-free trial, whatever, then that actually helps the negotiation along the way considerably.
Right. So what sort of tools would you use to analyse risk? What sort of thinking would you follow to get to the bottom of whether something is riskier than something else?
Well, I think really risk is all dependent on how comfortable you feel and the amount of information you've got about the product. If it's a product that is unknown, then obviously the risk is considerably high because it doesn't have a track record. But as part of that negotiation, you should be understanding what the potential of the product actually is. And if I'm going to do a 3-month trial basis, at the end of that, are you as the salesman going to take the stock back? Are you going to help me clear it? Or what's my exit strategy if it doesn't work? On the positive side, because obviously we want to look at positives more than negatives, it's if it does work, will you be able to meet the demand? You know, and there are loads of instances where we start with a product, it's really successful, disastrous if you can't actually supply the product within a month's time because it's done so well. So the risks are very much based around the product, the supply, and also the marketplace. One of the biggest issues these days is competitive market. So if you take a product in and you find, for want of a better description, Amazon, other companies are available, if Amazon take the product and they slash the price and you as the buyer have taken a risk on it, well, you're stuffed.
Right. So a salesperson that appreciates the risk involved and helps you minimize that would, in your view, be more successful then?
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Because often from a sales point of view, they think that's just a buying ploy. which I'm sure might be the case, but underpinning that, there is some genuine degree of concern about risk.
I think more so these days. I think where every piece of stock has value and, you know, you're concerned about the length of time it takes to clear it. And I think in general in retail, one of the biggest issues these days is that people get stuck with old stock and then they won't buy new stock. And then the whole thing becomes a sales cycle, which is not good for the customer at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
To guide the market.
Yeah. Okay. Looking at suppliers then that you've dealt with or your team have dealt with, what's the biggest mistake that they make when it comes to negotiating?
Aha, that's an easy one. I can say two of those straight away. One, which is one of my pet hates, is providing too much periphery material, better known as the fluff. I've been subjected to 50-page presentations and, you know, people want to get across so much about their company, their brand, their product. And you know, a lot of the time, the buyers, they're like, really? Get to the point. Get to the bit that I want to know about. I don't have time to listen to 20 pages of waffle. So I think one of the things is very much too much periphery material. And the second one is, and it's an interesting one, I think it's maybe changing a little bit, but historically, they leave the numbers till the end. And the terms to the end. Well, any good buyer is going to go straight to the end of the presentation and look at them while they're going through the waffle in the first 20 pages. And that, it's funny, I have actually in the last 6 months, I've spent a lot of time, and actually over this particular period, I've offered a free service for some companies to go through their brand presentation and be brutally honest. And I am brutally honest.
I can imagine.
Because you'd be amazed at the quality of brand presentations. It's like a marketing tick the box exercise. It doesn't ever consider really what the buyer wants to see. You know, There has to be something that tells them, why do I want to buy that product? Why your product? You know, apart from the price, but what makes me want to buy it?
And early on in the meeting, I guess.
You know, early on in the meeting.
I call it the hook. You need to get the hook out initially.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I don't care that it's a 5-generation family and a picture of them all on their suits waving hello. Yes. I really don't care. Yes. I want to know what the product is and why I should consider it.
It's the so what test, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I often say, you know, okay, that's very interesting, but so what? What does that what would that mean to a buyer? Why is that of interest to them? It isn't of interest to them.
Interesting.
Let's go back to the fluff area then. So I understand what you mean. I see that quite often in sales teams as well. Are you saying that fluff is totally unnecessary, or is that the sort of fluff that would be more useful in a leave behind or a send on after the presentation?
Funny enough, I would say if you went into any buying department and you opened up a cupboard, you will find an awful lot of company profile brochures that have never, ever had a page turned. I think if anybody believes when they leave one of those presenters behind that the buyer is ever going to read it, the chances are slim. So there's a lot of marketing expense there that I think people go to that is not so necessary. When you say, is the fluff necessary? Some of it is. Of course it is. Some of it paints the picture. Some of it delivers the brand image and the passion about the brand. But managed within, and make it personal. Make it personal. You know, so yes, of course you need a certain amount of company information and brand information. It's very important. But make it a little bit more about the market. Make it a bit more about where they are, what the vision is, where they're going to go with it.
Right. Right. Okay.
Not static. I think that's probably the best description, is make it not static.
In what way?
Well, company history for 20 pages. Where's it going? I want to know where it's going. I don't really care where it's been.
Right. Okay. 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 And how that presumably their future vision aligns with your future vision of your business then?
Completely. Yeah. Completely.
Yeah. Okay. Which negotiation do you look back on with the most satisfaction, and why that particular one?
Well, apart from the 5 million negotiations I've done, that's quite a hard one to answer. But there's so many types of negotiation. I mean, you know, your concept development, of landlord negotiations, global deals. And even now, you know, I negotiate for my own consultancy business today. But as I said, I was passionate about product. I'll use an example from that. And just to paint the picture, as a passionate buyer, the buzz you get when you're presented a product that you can see fills a gap in your portfolio, the retail position is right, the product has potential of volume sales, you know it's going to be successful. When you know the brand has international appeal and has the legs to go global, then you get to the heart of the negotiation and terms. And as I said before, terms are not just about margin and price, terms are about everything. So the example I have in my head was a supplier who came to see me with a product that they actually didn't realize had the potential that I could see in it. So it was quite an interesting start to the meeting, where they pretty much were just bringing in a lukewarm product with a lukewarm selling approach. Negotiation was a long one, but when I saw their designs, the concept, the price and the plan, I knew this was something that I had to have in the business. It goes back to the one I mentioned earlier about knowing if they can do the production to satisfy the volume. And I could see this product was going to have huge volume. So that changed the angle of the negotiation to be about, okay, how do we soft launch it? How do we manage it? Which stores do we put it in to have a phased rollout program? So there were lots of different facets to consider. I knew I could push the margin because I could give them premium in-store positioning. Again, as a buyer, you know what you can deliver and can you actually deliver it? And we agreed terms on volume. We got involved in designing self-select stands, again, within an airport, which most of my work has been in, have very rigid guidelines for stands.
Just for those that don't know, what's a self-select stand?
a sandwich is basically where the customer self-selects.
Out on the open shop floor.
On the shop floor, it doesn't require a member of staff to serve you. That's the best description.
Gotcha.
Sometimes my terminology, I'm so used to it, I forget other people might not know it. And then knowing that this product could go globally, we looked at the international expansion from the beginning, from the initial negotiation, because whatever terms we struck, we had to be able to manage those in the long term on a wider market. So it was very complex. We had to take into consideration extra costs, currencies, customs, shipping. What minimum orders would there be? This was a watch category, so you didn't want someone ordering three watches because it wasn't cost effective to send it. So there's, you know, those kind of things. But it was very satisfying. And in the end, we drove the business from zero to £1.5 million retail sales in 12 months.
Fantastic.
So the good thing is both myself and the supplier came away very happy. And more importantly, the customer on the shop floor was very happy because they bought it.
Yeah. Okay. And that's interesting. The point you make about customer focus, that shines through, you're explaining in terms of the facets around your role and, the myopic view of the customer and the unflinching view of what will the customer buy from me.
Yeah.
And that shines through. And again, you went through the importance of that. Mm. Do you think sometimes suppliers lose sight of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think buyers lose sight of it as well, if I'm honest.
Okay.
I think probably one of the worst things a buyer can do is buy what they like. And there are a lot of buyers out there who buy what they like, not what the customer wants.
Right. So they buy to their own personal preference then.
Correct.
Forgetting that there's actually a market and a customer out there that might not like the same thing.
A lot of buyers do that because it's actually quite hard if you think about it. You know, I'll give you a very good example from my early days where I had to buy pickled fish off the deli counter. Well, I detest pickled fish.
What a glamorous life it sounds.
But I had to taste that damn product every week. Well, you know, I still didn't like it at the end, but you have to think what the customer wants.
Yeah. You mentioned the great phrase. You said about terms are about everything, not just about price. Tell me more. What sort of variables, to use the phrase, what sort of variables apart from price you feel are important?
Well, I think there's a lot these days, but I think it's about the warranty of the product. Is that a sales? Is that something that in staff training that can be brought across? So sales training. What's the market position, the size and the scope? I've mentioned before, what's the exit strategy? Because that's also very important. Also, one of the things which I guess encapsulates all of that is what's the marketing plan? Am I going to get exclusivity? Am I the first to market to launch it? Who are my competitors? Those kind of things are also very, very important.
Okay.
And price positioning.
Yeah. On my course, I speak about tangible variables.
Mm-hmm.
Things you can see, quantity, price, things mm-hmm. like that. And mm-hmm. I also speak about intangible variables, things like brand heritage,
mm-hmm.
Customer loyalty, the intangibles, the things you can't actually place a financial value on, nevertheless have value.
Yeah. And I think for me, those two things, one will be the must-haves, because if you don't get the financials right, you haven't got a deal. But the intangible ones will be more about building that trust and again limiting the risk for the buyer, because it has some kudos, it has some heritage, it has whatever that supports the fact of where it wants to be in the market.
And I'm wondering whether what you've said about some buyers in your experience have kind of had vanity purchases, things that they like.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if they're over exaggerating the intangible variables, the feeling, the intuition around a brand, they're overvaluing that. They're undervaluing, will it sell to a customer? The actual tangible cash in the till.
Absolutely. No, there's no doubt that there is that balance to be had. I mean, again, it comes back to you have to be passionate about product, but your passion shouldn't overweigh the actual commercial terms and conditions, because that's what's going to make you money at the end of the day.
Yeah. We have, I, asked, I asked my LinkedIn connections if they would, if they were interviewing yourself, Moira, what question would they ask of you? We've kind of already touched upon that, but it was, what's the biggest mistake that buyers make? Now, you've mentioned around losing focus on the customer and buying from their own, you know, for their own, their own recognition, or their own, from their own point of view. Would there be any other mistake, or the biggest mistake that you feel that buyers make?
Buyers don't make mistakes. Salesmen make mistakes selling to buyers. But no, joking aside, I think, as I said, that we've covered some of the things that mistakes that buyers make. There's also so many buyers these days accept the first offer in a negotiation. I don't think negotiations take the form that they should do with buyers. They're too much a case of tick the box, I've got a margin, therefore I've got the percentage margin. And also, again, it's a bigger picture and a bigger story, but I think businesses who balance everything on percentage margin is a big mistake, because cash margin is much more valid. And yet most of the companies I've worked for have always put the emphasis for the buyer on percentage margin, which is crazy. So I think a good buyer, in the same way as a good salesperson, should have a portfolio of ways to improve the deal, a bit like the tangible and intangible things we've just been talking about. I think you need to have that portfolio in your repertoire. You need to be able to know what to pull, what's important for that deal. And a lot of buyers are very focused on margin, margin, margin. And that's a mistake.
Yeah. Okay. So it's thinking, I say to the sales teams that I work with, yeah, think broader than margin, you know, brainstorm, I call it trade storm, but you know, brainstorm all potential variables that you or the buyer might well have. It is interesting. Some of them do struggle beyond price, margin, quantity, volume.
Because those are the things they've been told to get. They're the tick list. The tick list of, yeah, I've got my margin now. That's fine. I take that. But I can give you 100%, well, 90% margin, but you might not sell any.
Yeah.
Because you don't know the other things. So profitability has to really be examined in more detail. So but I think that's probably the weakest part from the buyers.
Yeah, it's interesting that what I see as a weakness from the sales is also, in your view, a weakness from buyers as well, who don't see beyond the percentage margin as opposed to the cash margin. Who place so much emphasis on the gross margin rather than the net cash margin. Okay. Yeah. So that was the audience question from Rob Hoblin. So Rob, that was your question that you put forward on LinkedIn. If we're coming to the end, but if you were to give one tip, one nugget, and one real insight to both buyers and sellers about successful negotiation, Moira, what would that be? Let's look at the buyer's point of view first of all. One nugget for a buyer.
Be honest, be clear, and don't waste time.
That's short and to the point.
Well, no, I mean, at the end of the day, I think buyers, you know, I think so much about a negotiation, and this is sort of for buyers and salesmen, is understand the body language in the negotiation. I think that is so important. And again, through experience, if you're sitting in front of a supplier who is going to go through their 30-page presentation, whether you want to see all 30 pages or not, and your body language is telling them, actually, I'm bored by page 2, and you don't pick up on it, you've got a problem. Likewise, a buyer on the other side has to show a certain amount of respect for the fact there is a 30-page presentation and not slam the door. So, you know, I think the body language and understanding the personality of your counterpart is actually very important in negotiation for both sides.
Okay. All right. Particularly where you're dealing with a client that you can't afford to lose, where you have a long established relationship, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, and it's funny you say that, because more and more these days, those relationships are harder to preserve, because business needs and demands mean that the buyers usually don't have the same close relationship that they had with their suppliers before. And the commercials become important. So even before, what my earlier days of buying, a supplier who'd been dealing with you for 10, 15 years, you wouldn't dare remove them from the business. But these days, I think that has changed. And I think there is a lot more cutthroat in that supplier also has to consider their business, relaunch their business and be building it with you, not just resting back and saying, yeah, well, we've always done it this way because that just doesn't happen anymore.
Okay, so do you feel previously there was a degree of supplier complacency then? That's
absolutely. There still is. You know, right. They would never get rid of me. Well, these days I wouldn't say that was necessarily the case.
Okay, so would that translate into your top tip for a supplier then? That's kind of mentality?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for the top tip for the supplier is to set the tone in the negotiation and manage the speed of it. So by the body language, by reading the personality of the buyer, actually manage the negotiation. And again, for both of them, actually, I would say confirm it in writing. Again, we are so bad these days, and so many conversations that you have with people, and you've both come away with different ideas of what you've achieved.
And then you have to start again, I guess, because my understanding is different to your understanding.
Or you don't. The thing is, often, if that happens, you lose the negotiation full stop because the buyer's not going to go back in and redo it.
Yeah.
In those cases, buyers will be arrogant and say, no, I'm sorry, this is what we agreed. And if it's not what you've agreed, then it's very tough for the salesman to actually redo the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really critical to be clear as to what you're negotiating for and about.
Yeah. And to tailor that to, you mentioned about the characteristics of the buyer. I'm guessing, you know, in my experience of sales in the last sort of 20, 30 years, you know, I got better at identifying the buyers that did want chapter and verse and valued that and did want the fluff, as we call it, that they wanted that.
Yeah.
But I also got more experienced and I got to recognise buyers that didn't want that. Maybe wanted that sent on afterwards, but wanted to cut straight to the chase. And I adapted my style over because I became more experienced. Mm. And that sounds that's the right thing. From your point of view, that was the right 100%. Thing for me to do.
Absolutely, 100%. It's like if I was in a negotiation and I had a junior buyer with me, there's two different things that would need to be required in that negotiation.
Yeah.
You know, it is really important to pitch it at the right level.
Yeah. Moira, you've shared with us some fantastic insights. I've learned a lot. You know, I've sort of been on the sales side of the desk for the 20, 30 years. So you've shared with some real insights and you've kind of reassured me that few things I was doing was right. But you've also shone the light on a few areas that, you know, I look back on and maybe I would have handled differently. Mm. So it's been a fantastic session. Thank you for that.
It's been my pleasure.
Where can people find out more about Moira Race?
Well, I've recently updated my website and it's www.moirarace.com. So that's dead easy to find. I'm on LinkedIn.
Moira with a Y.
Moira with a Y. Always Moira with a Y. And Race, spelled R-A-C-E, because my accent might throw that a little bit.
Yeah, so spell Y-R-A, Moira Race, R-A-C-E.
Correct, all one word. Find me there.
Dot com or
.com? .com.
MoiraRace.com. Okay. Yep. All right.
And obviously I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Okay. Fantastic. Moira, thank you for giving so much of your time up for this. I'm sure everyone that listens into this will find it incredibly helpful. So thanks once again.
No problem at all. Good to speak to you.